Hello and welcome to the Money Talk podcast. I'm Ed Monk. Millennials love to complain that baby boomers have had it easy, and baby boomers reply back that millennials don't know they're born. But which generation has been the luckiest, financially speaking? Tom Stevenson joins me to help answer that vexed question. And then it's our interview with Rahil Altaf. He's manager of the Artemis Global Emerging Markets Fund. If you enjoy the show, please rate us, share us, or leave a comment wherever you get your podcasts. In amongst all the other things we're fighting about these days are the differing fortunes of the old versus the young. A narrative has taken hold that older people of the baby boomer generation have enjoyed the best of it, financially speaking, with those following in Generation X, the millennials in particular, and even the younger Generation Z faring less well. But is that really true? To help answer that, I'm joined by Tom Stevenson, Investment Director here at Fidelity. Tom, before we get too far into this, I should acknowledge that any sort of really definitive mathematical answer to that question is going to be pretty much impossible. We're comparing all sorts of different things that aren't particularly comparable. But I did think it would be an interesting exercise to talk about. So let me start then by asking about that perception that exists that older people have had an easier life financially. Where do you think that comes from?
Well, I'm a good person to ask because, I mean, probably the first thing we should do is sort of position ourselves in this Fine. Conversation. So, I mean, technically speaking, on the sort of generally agreed definitions, I am a late baby boomer. So born in 63, I think baby boomers go until 65. Mm. So I'm kind of on the cusp between baby boomers and Generation X.
Well, yeah. So I'm sort of very similar. The other one sort of further on. So right at the end of Generation X, even by some definitions that you'll see, people born in 1980, which includes me, will be included as millennials. I don't feel like a millennial.
Look like a millennial.
In all the important ways, I'm Generation X, I think. So that's what we're talking about. And actually, it's interesting that we're both late in a generation because, as we'll come on to talk about, that makes an absolutely huge difference.
Yeah, it does. And it's very interesting because, and the reason why I mentioned it was I don't really feel like a baby boomer because, you know, when we talk about these generational divides and the gap between the boomers and the millennials, I recognize some of the accusations, you know, do sort of resonate with me. I mean, it's certainly true that I'm of the generation that got lucky with the housing market, for example. And I think that when we ask the question, why do people feel that older generations had it easier than younger generations? I think largely that's what we're talking about in this country, because I think it's such a massive difference in people's fortunes, no reflection at all on their abilities or their hard work or anything. It's just pure luck when they were born, and I think it colours everything else. And you know, a lot of our conversation, I suspect, will be about stock market returns.
Yeah.
But actually, I don't think that's how most people view the world. Most people view the world of, am I lucky enough to own a house, or am I never going to get on the housing ladder?
Yeah, and all these things intersect, don't they, really? You know, pension provision is another big part of that. And it's probably another thing I'd raise as a sort of differentiator between what we're going to generalise as baby boomers, many of whom had access to pensions which simply will not be matched in terms of generosity from now on, will
yes,
they?
Yes, and indeed are not matched even for my generation.
Indeed.
So, you know, that's why I say I don't really feel like a boomer, because, yes, I got lucky with the housing market. No, I absolutely didn't get lucky with the pension market.
Yeah.
Like most of my peers, and certainly anyone younger than me, I have paid into a defined contribution pension scheme. So at the back of my mind is always this nagging fear, what's going to happen to the markets?
Mm.
Because all of that money that I've saved over the years could disappear in a way that my parents' generation, you know, they'd never have to think in those terms.
Yeah.
As far as they're concerned, I mean, both of my parents happened to work for the state, you know, the Air Force, a teacher, You know, they both got state pensions. They never have to worry about that money not arriving. It will arrive until the day they die.
Yeah. Well, so having said that, it's useless to look at it through the lens of investment returns. That's exactly what we're going to do. But I think there is worth in it because, you know, you can take that as a bit of a proxy for growth in the economy, I think, and the global economy. And attached to that are all sorts of things about the jobs market and all the rest of it. So we'll have a bit of a look. Lots of caveats, obviously, to all this. Like you say, you've got this huge expanse within a generation of what counts as one particular generation. It also matters when you started investing. So it's basically very difficult to chop up history in terms of this is when the boomers were investing, this is when Generation X was investing. Nevertheless, I tried to do this. I actually did this for a newspaper article I was asked to contribute to, so that's why I've done these numbers for what they're worth. So looking at them, a few things jump out. There did seem to be a bit of a sweet spot in investment terms, well, in terms of investment returns, at least, but in the 70s and 80s, if you look at the period between 1971 and 1990, which I've assumed the oldest baby boomers will have been investing in, you get something like a 12% annualized return, looking at the S&P 500, which is, frankly, the easiest one to look at. That's really quite healthy in terms of investment returns compared to what we get
Yes,
today.
And of course it throws up lots of interesting questions. You know, like, you know, that return sounds great. It would have required you to have remained fully invested over that whole period.
Indeed.
If you look at what happened in that period, you know, certainly in both the 1970s and the 1980s, huge upheavals, political upheavals, economic upheavals. You know, to have had the sort of strength of mind and the persistence and patience to just see it through would have been very difficult. And it would have been very possible not to have had that, even if you'd been an investor during the whole of that period, not to have had that outcome. Because, you know, in the early 1970s, you would have, you know, panicked and bailed out of the market or whatever.
The oil price shock in the 70s, winter of discontent in the UK, at least, in the late 70s.
Big recession in the early 1980s, the stock market crashes in 1987. That period actually was a very testing time. And the other thing to bear in mind during the 1970s and 1980s, of course, is the impact of inflation. Which you can't ignore. You know, those nominal rates of returns, fantastic, but you needed those just to stand still.
Many, many years in that period would have had inflation above 10% and sometimes above 20%, which is hair-raising, really, in the context of
today. I can remember my parents in the 70s and 80s saying, you know, what should we do with this money? Well, spend it, because, you know, it's going to be worth less in a year's time. So what's the point in holding on to it? So it's important to bear in mind, you know, the mindset in these difficult economic periods.
A couple of things to say about that sort of period as well. Quite a good jobs market. I mean, you'd had after the war, lots of rebuilding. Life really was tougher in the post-war years. But by the time you get to sort of midway through the 60s, actually you get quite a full labour market, a full jobs market, and opportunities opening up. If we move on a little bit from... And I should say here, of course, that we're talking now, for example, about the Generation X from 1990 to about 2006 is how I've chunked it up. The baby boomers got that as well. They experienced that as well as... Yeah. Young people do. So this is all a bit fictional.
Is a bit fictional. And also, but another very interesting point here is that the baby boomers would have been, in the period that you've just talked about, the baby boomers would have been at a different stage of their investing life cycle. And they would have had much more to lose.
Indeed.
In the big events that happened in the market. So, for example, you know, in 2000, between 2000 and 2003, when the market fell by 50%, and again, 6-7 years later, you know, I was an investor at the time, but I was very young and I was very new into my investing journey. And actually, it didn't really make any difference.
Probably quite a good thing to happen early in your investing career.
Made no difference, really, that I lost money because I had so little to lose. But if I'd been in my late 40s or 50s at the time, what a traumatic event that would have been to lose 50% of your savings. you know, when you're coming towards the end of your working career would have been devastating. And indeed it was for lots of people.
Yeah. Well, I did, again, I looked at the annualized return over that period, slightly lower at about 10%, still 10%, not bad, not bad at all. Okay. We move on from that to 2006, and when I've assumed the very eldest, which probably should include me really, the eldest millennials would have been investing. The period since then, of course, covers the financial crisis. They would have had a year or two of decent, let's call it normal growth, and then along comes 2008. We touched on it there. Not a bad time to get investing, just as a crash happens, because you get the growth that immediately follows it.
Yes, and it has been a very long period of, you know, not completely steady growth. There have been ups and downs along the way, but basically we haven't had any really, really bad years. And coming back to your point about not a bad lesson to learn early in your investing career, as it was for me, the dot-com crash, you know, for quite a lot of people, they've actually had now 11 years in which markets are just basically actually become a bit complacent now, and they think that that's what markets do. Well, you know, at some point we will have other bad years, and so yes, I totally agree. Getting started in 2008-09, that was a lucky break. If you could have got in just after the market crash, but you know, it's not going to go on forever.
And a couple of things to say about this period and these people, these young people. Many of them just simply will not have cared about the investment markets because they would have been more concerned with jobs, because that's the real, you know, you enter the jobs market during a recession, you can't get a job. And that was a familiar story during those years. And I knew lots of people that would look for jobs, couldn't get it, had to take sort of, you know, substandard jobs that they were overqualified for.
Yeah.
Suddenly then they're competing with the next year's cohort of graduates or whatever it is for those jobs. Really, really, really tough. I would forgive that generation for feeling that they had a hard time of it.
Yes, but I would say to that those circumstances are not unique. I graduated in 1985. The early 1980s recession lingered for many years, actually, after the numbers started looking better. 1984, 1985, there were very few jobs, actually. And it was a really traumatic time. So I think when young people do say, oh, you know, that generation had it much easier, in some ways they did, and in other ways, you know, they had different problems, but and similar problems as
yeah.
well.
And you know, and it makes you think about things like student debt for that generation. It would have been quite high. They got hammered by the increase, or many of them did get hammered by the increases. But at the same time, the jobs market they entered into probably would have afforded them far more opportunities than had you entered the jobs market in 1980 or even 1990. There would have been lots of parts of the country, lots of parts of the population who just simply wouldn't have had it on their horizon that they could go to university, get qualified, get a professional career, and have that sort of social mobilisation.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's too easy to generalise about generations and say, well, one had it easier than the other. They had different problems. They had different opportunities, and so look at my generation. You know, free tertiary education. What a fantastic boon that was. In at the right time in the housing market. You know, that's made a big difference to my life. But along the way, you know, there was a lot of inflation around.
Negative equity in, you know, early 90s, horrible things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I bought my first flat in 1989. And now I was lucky because I bought in a part of London, which actually was, you know, going through the process of gentrification. And when did I sell that flat? 4 years later, I sold it for the same price that I bought it at. Very, very lucky, because that was not the experience of a lot of people. A lot of people who bought in the wrong area, if you like, what is the wrong area, they lost 20%. Yeah. You know, so basically their down payments were wiped out. So negative equity was a big problem in the early 90s.
Yeah. Finally then, we're going to talk about Gen Z, which there isn't much to talk about because it hasn't really happened yet. But they are entering this world where they will be told that everything is going to remain lower for longer. Lower growth, lower inflation, lower investment returns. Is that here to say? I mean, it's interesting that we've gone over the numbers. They're all a lot higher than you might assume. 7% in the worst sort of period, 10% annualized return, 12%. It doesn't have to be, lower for longer doesn't have to mean sort of 0%, does it?
No, it doesn't. And the opportunities that will arise are things that we maybe haven't even, thought about yet.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you look at it from the perspective of someone in the 1980s, you know, the unfolding of the internet and, you know, all sorts of other developments, biotechnology, all these opportunities, all the disruptive changes in the world that we've seen, you know, no one could have imagined those. And who's to say that we won't get some other disruptive change to the way the global economy is run that will create lots of investment opportunities? So I think it's very easy at the time to think, oh, things are very difficult. It's also very easy to look back and say, oh, well, it was obvious why, you know, that was a good buying opportunity or whatever.
Yeah.
At the time, you just don't know. So, you know, I think that, you know, you have to be an optimist. You have to be hopeful and you have to do sensible things, spreading your money around, being well diversified, all of those things that we talk about a lot. But they're as true today as they were 20 years ago.
Indeed. Okay, well, I don't know what conclusions we'll draw from all that, but it was an interesting discussion nonetheless. Tom, that's all we have time for. Thanks.
Thanks.
Emerging markets can provide the potential for growth that more developed markets struggle to match, but it's rarely a straightforward ride for investors. There's plenty spooking emerging markets right now, which presents an opportunity, according to Raheel Altaf, the manager of the Artemis Global Emerging Markets Fund. He sat down recently with my colleague Dan Lane, and what you hear now is an edit of their conversation.
I thought we could start off, global emerging markets, that seems like a massive remit. Maybe you could give us a sense of the opportunity set here.
Emerging and frontier economies often have growth opportunities that aren't readily available within developed markets. Countries such as China and Brazil may have some of the brightest investment stories for the future at times where the likes of Argentina and Turkey are seeing challenges. So it's far from a uniform group. But I think some of the longer term drivers that are leading to faster economic growth make it a very compelling asset class for investors. And I think emerging markets are likely to generate strong returns in the future. I think they offer a great diversification potential as well.
And in terms of how you would select companies for the fund, you incorporate a process called SmartGARP. Wonder if you could tell us what this is and how you use it.
SmartGARP is it's a stock screening tool. So it's data-driven and it's very systematic. It's designed to get us to focus on where the investment opportunities are. By using a systematic approach to screening, we're trying to capture quite a simple investment philosophy. We're looking for companies that are undervalued where there are some attractive growth prospects. That's a simple philosophy, but to capture that in a process, what we're really doing is focusing on some of the bottom-up drivers and some of the key top-down drivers for a company. I think the systematic approach allows you to cover a very broad investment universe very efficiently. So our job as the fund manager is then to take those best ideas that come from the screening approach and then look at the real world reasons for why we should be investing in them. Often we're just looking for reasons of improvements that are likely to persist into the future.
And this process, does this lead you into specific maybe biases in terms of industry or geography, or how does that work?
Well, the screening approach tries to capture some of the best dynamics of a range of different styles, and it is unemotional in the way it goes about looking for those opportunities. And so over the cycle, we would expect to have allocations to most of the sectors and most regions within emerging markets. But if you look at the fund right now, then there's a contrarian tilt within it. And we have a bias towards those companies that have been overlooked by other investors. telecom operators and utilities are one example, but other beneficiaries of infrastructure spending that's likely to come, particularly from Asian economies, is another area of importance within the fund. And I can give you a stock example. We have many in the fund. It's a diversified fund. It's high active share. But there's one stock which follows that theme. It's Contrarian, and it sits in an area that benefits from infrastructure spending. And Hui Conch is the second largest cement manufacturer in China. It has some long-term drivers that are coming through from the fact that China has a commitment to the One Belt, One Road initiative. And there are some clean air policies that are in place that are leading to cement prices rising. The valuation on the company is cheaper than it has been, and it's an area that is under-owned amongst other investors. So there are some catalysts in place that we think are important, and that's one of the ideas that we have within the fund.
Interesting, thanks. And moving more broadly into emerging markets, a bit of unease at the minute. Is that what we should really be focusing on, or what are we overlooking here?
Well, I think undoubtedly slowing global growth, tensions around global trade, and potentially a strengthening dollar is likely to have some impact on developing economies. But we do find that headlines tend to dominate sentiment, and therefore emerging markets can be volatile. As fund managers, our job is to really focus on the news and see the impact that that's having on the underlying companies. Are the fundamentals changing? Are they thriving through this challenging environment? Often, as the news flow becomes less bad, there's an investment opportunity there. And so it's important to look past the headlines and focus on the key drivers for companies, because it's the stock picking that really delivers returns in the long term.
And is this where your smart GARP tool, is that when that comes into its own, getting rid of behavioural biases and headlines and looking at the fundamentals?
That's right. It's designed to remove those biases. It's designed to go against the consensus when it becomes very crowded. And it's designed to focus on really where the opportunities are and where they're coming through.
And if we take ourselves away from kind of the headlines now, there are still long-term demographic changes taking place in many parts of global emerging markets. You mentioned China and the need for oodles more cement as we develop there. What's your take on the long-term development in global emerging markets, and how are you positioned?
I think the long-term view on emerging markets is a positive one. The drivers for emerging markets are likely to continue in that there are some positive demographics there. We've got a rising middle classes that is leading to changing patterns in terms of consumption. And there are also advances in technology that are leading the way when it comes to global innovation. So the landscape for emerging markets has changed quite a bit, but there are some very positive demographics, increasing urbanization, the fact that rural areas are changing, and the economies are moving from being manufacturing or agricultural led to being focused much more on the underlying consumer themselves. And these are likely to feed through into good returns for investors as long as you're able to find the right opportunities that benefit from that underlying environment itself.
And if we look at China, very obviously wanting to move away from this kind of being the world's toy factory into a country of consumption, can you see within emerging markets that shifting, that manufacturing shifting into other countries that will then develop and then shift again?
We've seen that trend over the last decade. Asian economies in particular are starting to trade much more with each other than they ever used to. They've taken moves to insulate themselves from the falls in demand that can occur when there are problems in the West. And that's had a positive impact on those economies, and it's fueling further growth there. And I think there's more potential growth to come in the future. We're somewhat early in the cycle for some of these economies in terms of the level of urbanization or the income per capita that we see within them.
And moving into our own portfolios now, what type of investor do you think that the Artemis Global Emerging Markets Fund would attract?
Well, I think for investors who don't have any allocation to emerging markets, then this is a core offering that gives you exposure to the broad asset class, but it's focused on trying to identify those companies that are likely to deliver better returns. And so it's a great fund for those investors who don't have any exposure. But for those more seasoned investors who do have exposure to emerging markets in other funds, then I think this is very complementary. I mentioned that there's a contrarian tilt here. We have a bias towards cheaper companies, and value investing has really gone out of favour. But this is a fund that has delivered good returns, whilst some of our growth and quality counterparts have also delivered good returns. So it's a very complementary offering for those investors who already hold emerging markets.
Rahil, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Money Talk podcast. Check fidelity.co.uk for daily written updates and articles on these and other topics from across Fidelity in the UK. And subscribe via iTunes to get the podcast downloaded direct to your devices every week. Please be aware that the value of investments and the income you get from them can go down as well as up, so you may not get back what you invest. This information doesn't constitute investment advice and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision, nor should it be treated as a recommendation for any investment. Eligibility to invest in an ISA or a pension and the value of tax savings depends on personal circumstances, and all tax rules may change. You will not normally be able to access money held in a pension until the age of 55. Reference to specific securities or funds should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell these securities or funds and is included for the purpose of illustration only. Fidelity Personal Investing does not give personal recommendations. If you're unsure about the suitability of an investment, you should speak to an authorised financial advisor.